Mr. Farrey, good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. I slept in this morning, Stephen.
Right, great.
Which means you may have an advantage over me today.
I was up at the crack of dawn revising.
Were you? Revising for this, are you?
Oh, indeed.
You don't need to prepare for this. All my questions are really easy. Alliance is opposed to a border poll. Why?
Well, we don't think it's appropriate at this time. It is going to be a further source of instability. I mean, already we're reeling from the fact we don't have an executive, a functioning assembly, all the consequences that flow from that. We have the challenge of Brexit. So I think a border poll just adds another layer of uncertainty to the situation we find ourselves in.
Or maybe it's because it puts you on the spot for someone like me to say, so why don't we just clear this up now? Would you recommend voting for a United Ireland or Northern Ireland staying within the UK?
Well, we don't have a border poll, so that question does not arise.
And it's arising because I'm asking it. Oh, it which is. Would you rather not?
And that, what I would say is that I would take a view on that in the prevailing circumstances where we find ourselves.
Do you have a view now?
In that situation. Well, my view now is, first of all, we have the principle of consent. That's how we determine the issue. There's no evidence of a desire amongst the people of Northern Ireland for any change in the situation, so the issue for border poll should not arise.
But does the Alliance Party currently have a position as to whether Northern Ireland would be better off in United Ireland or the UK?
The Alliance Party is not a party that's defined by the constitutional question.
Well, I've asked you.
I know it's not the question you've asked us, but this is the issue.
There's two answers you've given me to questions that I haven't asked.
There is this fixation with seeing the party through the lens of where we stand in terms of the border. The whole purpose of the Alliance Party is to be a challenge to that type of thinking. We are a party made up of people, who some of whom support the Union, some of whom have an aspiration for a United Ireland, but what unites us is a desire to see Northern Ireland work and to have a shared and reconciled, successful society. So the issue of a border poll is not something that we are fixated on, nor is the issue of the constitutional status. Sure. The situation is fine where we stand present.
Whether we like it or not, it probably is important to people in Northern Ireland as to for them to know where Alliance Party stands on it. Does the Alliance Party have a position in this at the moment?
Well, we have a position.
That fundamental question of United Ireland being part of the UK, what's better for us? You have no position on it.
The defining issue for the Alliance Party.
Does the Alliance Party have any position on it?
Well, the point is, isn't it a wonderful thing where we have a society that's divided between some people who are unionists, some people who are nationalists?
Stephen, my question is, does the party have a position?
The point is
the answer no.
The party does not have a position.
Okay, do you have a position?
For the very reason that we are a party that brings together people who are unionists and nationalists together. And that's actually something that's very valuable in the context of Northern Ireland.
I get that. Thank you. So the Alliance Party doesn't have a position on it. Fair enough, you answered that question. Just before I move on, what do you think?
Well, I think
do you have a position on it? You must have thought this through.
I think the situation where we find ourselves today is working in that particular context.
So you prefer Northern Ireland to be part of the UK?
I don't. At this stage, I don't see the basis for a change in that situation. Now, that said, obviously, and you may well come to this as a natural follow-on, the uncertainty around Brexit adds
certain degree of complications. If there was a border poll tomorrow, would you vote for us to remain in the UK?
If there was a border poll tomorrow, personally, my instinct is I probably would vote to remain. It is something, however, I am open-minded on, and I could not rule out a situation where I would think differently in that regard. It is something where it is not something that defines my personal politics. You've asked me a question in terms of if it happened tomorrow, how would I vote?
Thank you for answering it.
I've given you the answer.
I feel like sounding a trumpet.
Equally, to be perfectly blunt about it, the situation may change in the future and I may see things differently, depending upon a whole range of economic and social factors and in terms of the finances in Northern Ireland and also the question around Brexit.
What is interesting there within your answer is that it may or may not be, I don't know, but it may be synonymous with what some other people of a certain age group think, where they kind of think, we don't care anymore about British Irish. We're Northern Irish.
Yes.
I don't know how many people that is.
Yeah. Well, the issue is that black and white choices, particularly in Northern Ireland, and indeed anywhere else, really often are very simplistic. They don't really, really work. And I think a lot of, in particular, young people want to have open, mixed identities. They want to be British, they want to be Irish, they want to be Northern Irish, they want to be European. They want to build friendships, relationships across traditional divides. And in some senses, those divides aren't particularly relevant for them. And that's in some ways, Stephen, the real tragedy of what we're seeing around Brexit, because over the past 20 years, we've seen real progress in Northern Ireland to building some degree of shared space facilitated by the European trade union, and people haven't had to make stark choices over identity. All of a sudden, a situation has arisen where Northern Ireland works best based upon sharing and interdependence, but Brexit is forcing people to make stark choices in terms of identity. It's forcing new divisions on people. It's potentially erecting new barriers, new borders, and that actually is something that runs very contrary to what we've been trying to build.
Let's talk then about Brexit. Your manifesto calls for special arrangements for Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. In a Brexit deal. How does that differ from the likes of Sinn Féin and the SDLP? Because they're demanding special status. You're demanding special arrangements. How are you different from those other parties?
Well, I would say probably that the primary difference is one of terminology, but it's one in which terminology is very important for this reason. It's important that whatever we do around Brexit, we recognise that Northern Ireland is a particular case. We have our special circumstances. Those have been recognised already through the Good Friday Agreement. We're facing stark choices.
That's what the other parties are saying.
I'm going to come to explain that particular context. The only way through this issue of Brexit is through a number of steps being taken. First of all, we need an executive in place that can articulate a plan for Northern Ireland as a whole. And secondly, we need to build a cross-community coalition of people, unionists, nationalists, progressives, all together who are working on a pragmatic basis to get the best outcome for Northern Ireland. The difficulty we're now facing is a situation where the term special status has become conflated with the notion of constitutional change, to go back to the point you started, Stephen.
Well, the question is, what's the difference between the special arrangements you want and the special status Sinn Féin and the SDLP want?
The point I'm trying to make is there's a fear being built up either deliberately or inadvertently, that's associating the concept of special status with a change in Northern Ireland's constitutional situation, which therefore polarises the whole debate as to how we actually mitigate the effects of Brexit. What we're trying to do in Alliance is say, let's talk about special deal. The substance of that around things like the single market and customs union may well be something where we have common cause with both the SDLP and Sinn Féin. It is about, first of all, it's about how we use language, and it's also our approach. We're very, very clearly making the point that the way through this can be achieved on a practical basis, focus upon economic and social issues and avoiding the issue of constitutional change. We want to give that assurance to people that what we're trying to talk about is something that can unite the community.
Okay.
And we see a real danger in the approach that has been taken by others.
So let's just step back from this for a second. So essentially what you're saying is this is down to two words. You're saying special arrangements. The other parties are saying special status, but actually what you want to happen is the same. There's no difference. You haven't told me any difference whatsoever. You've said it comes down to words, language.
And Northern Ireland, Stephen, you appreciate that words and presentation
are
important.
Yes or no, is there any policy difference in terms of what you want to achieve from what you're calling special arrangements and what Sinn Féin's calling special status?
Okay. Well, if you give me a moment, I will articulate what we mean by special arrangements. To be fair, it's probably up to other parties to clearly explain their position rather than me to interpret that. However, let me say that there is a suspicion, particularly when it comes to Sinn Féin, that their concept of special status is more about actually destabilising Northern Ireland and using Brexit as a failure to engage on a pragmatic basis as a means of destabilising Northern Ireland and actually trying to pursue wider objectives in terms of the island. For me, and what we're talking about a special arrangement is about stabilising Northern Ireland in terms of the current constitutional situation. Well, there's two key elements to this. One is the ability of Northern Ireland to continue to participate within the European single market, and secondly, what we're going to do in terms of the customs union. And I want Northern Ireland to be on the right side of that customs frontier. Those are the two key legs on which we build a special deal for Northern Ireland.
If the rest, Stephen, of the UK leaves the EU, do you believe Northern Ireland can stay in it?
Well, let me say that whenever we talk about a special arrangement, there is a spectrum of different options in that regard. At one end of that spectrum, and I don't think this is probably going to be viable, but let me just say it anyway, is Northern
Ireland. Let's not say it if it's not going to be viable.
Well, I'm not going to rule it out here, Stephen. But let me say, first of all, the notion of Northern Ireland being an associate member, I don't think should be entirely dismissed.
An associate member?
Associate member of the European Union. In practical terms, what we are probably talking is Northern Ireland becoming a member of the European Economic Area, which is akin to the situation where Norway currently interacts, Norway and Liechtenstein and Iceland.
Okay, so to come back to my question, just so that I understand, if the rest of the UK leaves the EU, can you see any conceivable way Northern Ireland could stay within it?
In practical terms, while I don't entirely dismiss the notion of associate membership, and it is worth exploring, to all intents and purposes, I think what we're talking about is something akin to the Norway model, where we're a member of the European Economic Area, and therefore we're continuing to be part of the single market and abiding by the four freedoms in terms of freedom of movement of labour, capital, goods and services.
Why do you want a second vote?
Well, it's important that the
you
people...
You want to ignore the referendum result.
Well, it's not a case of ignoring the referendum
result. Well, you don't like the answer, so you run the process again.
Well, what exactly were people voting for last year?
It's a pretty simple question, wasn't it?
People voted to leave the European Union, but there was never any clarity as to exactly what that meant. There's a whole range of opinions, and indeed many of the Leave campaigners at a UK level talked about the UK continuing to be part of the single market, still part of the customs union, but what Theresa May is doing is something that's very much a hard Brexit, where those have both been ruled out. So that's different from what some people thought they were voting for last year.
So your party's policy is that we will see what the deal is and we will run another referendum?
Yeah, the people should have their say in terms of the outcome of the negotiations.
So that's a rematch. That's another referendum on top of the last question.
Well, we should trust the people to make these decisions. This is a decision. This is not a general election where we're going to live with the consequences for 5 years. This is a decision where the UK is going to live with the consequences for decades, for many, many generations. It's not a decision that affects people today. It affects the future generations to come. Even if you look at somewhere like Switzerland, where they have a very strong culture in terms of referendums, they had a decision like back in 2014 in terms of some changes in terms of the freedom of movement. That was left to their government to work out the details. The government still have to go back to the people in terms of the final outcome of those negotiations. So that's put back to the people in Switzerland. So why should we be any different in the UK?
Let's move on, because I want to get into all the different policy issues that will affect real lives in this country. Your manifesto says that you propose to achieve 20% of children being educated in integrated schools within the next 10 years. What's the current percentage?
The current percentage is about 7, and that has been fairly stalled over the past 10 years.
So you're going to nearly triple it?
Yeah.
By opening more schools?
Well, I think we have some very difficult decisions to take in terms of our school sector at present. We have potentially pushing 80,000 empty school places, and that's in terms of a school-age population.
But would you be opening new schools?
Well,
triple this
in some very rare situations, yes, some new schools will be opened.
How many?
But what? Well, let me come to that in a second, Stephen. But the main way in which we're going to see a transformation in terms of our school system is in terms of how we approach the existing inefficient school estate. We have simply too many schools in Northern Ireland. We have too many small schools, and our education budgets are heavily skewed towards the school estate at the expense of investing both in terms of teachers and investing in pupils. You're very, very familiar with the current pressures on the education budget, the fact that virtually every school in Northern Ireland is struggling to make ends meet at present. So we need some radical change.
Right, and I'm wondering what that radical change is. So if you're going to triple the amount of children being educated in integrated schools within the next 10 years, are you going to force, against their will, schools to be integrated?
Well, we need to look across Northern Ireland, and the Education Authority is going through a process, in my view, a slightly flawed process, of identifying where there are inefficiencies in the school estate. We have different sectors doing their own rationalisation of their estate rather than working on a collective basis together. So if we have a single unified strategic approach, then we can have a situation where, say, for example,
let's concentrate on the question, though.
Yes.
May you force schools to be integrated against their will.
Well, the term
to achieve this.
The term force is somewhat pejorative. We have a situation where, in terms of school changes, that we go through a consultation process with the education authority. Will present its development proposals. They go out to put the consultation, and then a decision is made by the authority and then the minister. So this is a process where people are engaged. We see a situation where at the grassroots level there is strong demand for integrated education. Okay. Let me explain it this way, Stephen.
This
will help answer your question, Stephen.
I know, but rather than help answer it in a long way, I've no problem on you expanding the answer, but I just want to know the basics first, right? In order to achieve tripling the amount of children being educated in integrated schools, would the Alliance Party compel schools to be integrated?
The term compel is not appropriate.
It's a yes or a no.
I've explained.
Compel, insist. Is it a yes or a no?
What I'm saying is that the notion of forcing, compelling, is not how things are done in terms of the education system.
Okay, so you
system.
Would make it voluntary, voluntary, surely.
Well, first of all, we would certainly encourage the voluntary process of transformation of schools to integrated status.
But it's already voluntary.
But secondly, whenever we look to the issue of rationalisation of the school estate, we approach that through a process of engagement with communities.
Yes.
It's not about top-down enforcement.
But after you engage...
Yes.
If you cannot get anywhere close to tripling the amount of children being educated in integrated education, do you hold out the possibility of making it compulsory?
Well, let's not jump ahead to failure, Stephen. We have a situation where in opinion polls...
You're just avoiding that question, aren't you?
I'm not, because I'll ask
it one more time. Would you rule out compelling schools to be integrated?
And if you let me make 2 points, I will come to that.
You won't.
I am.
Because you keep on promising to come to it and you're not.
Well, you haven't let me. Now, let me
yes or no, would you rule out compelling schools to be integrated?
The term compulsion is not relevant in this discussion.
And then answer the meaning behind my question. Would you make it compulsory?
No.
Right.
So
thank you.
The point I'm making is that if we actually let this happen organically, things will change. We see a situation where 60-70% of parents want to have the integrated option. We're seeing a situation where parents themselves are taking into their own hands the transformation of schools.
So why is it only 7% now then?
Because the whole system has been rigged against the integrated system. It's all about defending the status
quo. Rigged in what way?
Well, it's about defending an existing segregated situation where we have different sectors and schools defend their existing
position. And I'm not trying to be facetious with you. I promise I'm not. Hold on. If you believe that the system is rigged, okay, then surely to achieve your objective, there's got to be some type of compulsory element in this to de-rig it, to unrig it, whatever the bloody term is. There's got to be some compulsion to take out the rigging of the system, if that's what you believe.
Well, my colleague Kelly Armstrong, whenever we had an assembly, was working on a private members bill to address some of the imbalances in the system. First of all, we don't have proper strategic planning around integrated schools. We have a situation where the existing sectors defend their own interests. We have a situation where the threshold to actually establish an integrated school and maintain it is overly rigorous. We don't have a situation where there's proper engagement and consultation, that the whole process around transformation isn't being properly publicised to parents. So there's a whole series of situations where change could happen, but people aren't being given that chance to proceed it. And let me give you the notion where you have a village in Northern Ireland, a random village, they have a state school, they have a Cathy Maintain school, perhaps two primary schools. Both are struggling in terms of numbers. The different sectors are saying, actually, we're going to have to make a very, very difficult call there. So we end up with a situation potentially where the children are actually bussed out of the village into a small town or a market town. What we're saying is you could actually maintain the local provision if you brought the two schools together for one single integrated school for that local community.
Is the Alliance Party, let's move on, is the Alliance Party the party that's going to bring in water charges and push up people's rates?
Well, first of all, we do need to look to some revenue raising in the context of Northern Ireland. That will be to our mind, the third thing we do in terms of how we approach our public finances, the first is we have to cut out waste around things like the social investment fund. Secondly, we have to address the cost of a divided society where we're maintaining a very inefficient system, not least, for example, in education that we've just spoken about. And then, thirdly, we would look to some means of revenue raising.
Okay, so would you bring in water charges?
I want to be very clear, Stephen. Whenever we talk about water charges, we do not see those as being a revenue raiser, but we see a change in terms of how we fund water, creating much greater efficiency. But the types of revenue raising that we would consider would be things around, for example, some modest increase in terms of the regional rate, but potentially introduction of prescription charges. Those are things, if you want to come to, but let me talk about water charges for a moment. The rationale at present is we have a very inefficient way of funding Northern Ireland water through what is in effect a subsidy. The big difference in that regard is because the Northern Ireland water does not have a reliable revenue stream coming in because it's subject to an ongoing political decision. Their ability to borrow well in terms of capital markets is restricted. If you move to a situation where they're funded by what is in effect a water charge, that provides them a much stronger funding stream in which they can go and borrow money to invest in what is a crumbling water infrastructure across Northern Ireland.
Okay, so that's the justification for it?
Yes.
So I presume that it is Alliance Party policy, therefore, that you intend to bring water charges into Northern Ireland?
In our manifesto, we have said, yes, that we would move to a water charge. But the critical issue here, Stephen, is that we do not see the water charge being a net increase in terms of the revenue taken from households. What we would do is move the amount of money that we would raise from a water charge and deduct that equivalent amount from someone's regional rate. And what we're saying is that you would get a bigger bang for your buck if that one same pound is raised through a water charge than it is through the regional rate. Because it opens up the whole spectrum in terms of borrowing.
So the promise that the Alliance is giving is that any water charge that would be deducted from our rates.
That's right.
So it makes no difference whatsoever.
It does. It makes a huge difference, Stephen, for the reason that I've just outlined. It's all about...
I thought we were talking in the context of revenue raising.
No, we're not. We're talking here about the bang for your buck. The point I'm making is, if you think about...
On public spending, you say some form of progressive revenue raising should be considered by the Northern Ireland Executive.
Yes.
So water charges would not be revenue raising.
The water charges in themselves would not be a revenue raiser. We've talked about things like a small increase in the rate itself.
How much of an increase in our rates?
Well, I mean, we're talking here in terms of a Westminster election rather than an Assembly election.
You've put in your manifesto for this election some form of revenue raising.
Yes, and we're talking
by the executive. So you've put it into the manifesto.
Yes, and as a general principle, Stephen,
how much would you put our rates up by?
Well, we have not been a part of the executive for the past year, so we don't have the full sight in terms of the current executive.
If you put it into your manifesto that you're going to put people's rates up, tell us how much.
What we're saying, Stephen, is that as a general point of principle, we are prepared to put our heads above the parapet and say that in terms of a situation where waiting lists are going through the roof, our health service is on the brink of collapse, we can't afford to pay our teachers, then yes, we do need to look at revenue raising.
Okay. By the way, you didn't put it in your manifesto you're going to put rates up. You've told us this morning. So how much would you put it up by?
And the point I'm making, Stephen, is taken in isolation of a global view of the overall budget, I can't give you an answer to that today. The point I'm making is that we would look...
So how do you know you're going to put them up then?
Well, let me say, there's two other elements that we would want to consider first before we look to revenue raising. The first one is the elimination of programmes that are clearly wasteful. For example, social investment fund. Secondly, tackling the cost of a divided society, where we have reports that indicate we're diverting as much as £1 billion every year to managing a divided society rather than investing in shared public services for the public good.
I'll say this to you and then we'll move on. For some people in this country, they have to save up for their rates. Mm-hmm. They just don't dip into a magic money tree and there they go, okay? Yeah. And rates in this country can be thousands of pounds for some people, hundreds of pounds, a week's wages, a month's wages for some people. So you're actually entering this election saying, we might put your rates up, but we're not telling you how much. We're not telling you even a nominal percentage. We're just telling you we might put them up. Well, by the way, vote for us.
Well, Stephen, the key point here is progressive taxation. So progressive taxation is based around people's ability to pay. And indeed, for those people who are on low incomes, they have considerable protection in that regard. But where people can pay a little bit more, we should be encouraging
that. How would you measure that? Well, so low-income earners would be excluded from any rates increase, would they?
Stephen, I'm not here today to set out a specific model in terms of
how this can be done. That you would consider revenue raising, and you're saying one of the ways is to put up rates.
You're saying it wasn't in the manifesto.
No, I'm saying you're saying this morning.
Yes. No, but the point I'm saying, Stephen, this is the third element of a three-pronged strategy in terms of how we bring some sanity to our public finances. And let's bear in mind, every single person in Northern Ireland depends upon the health service.
Yep.
The health service that's crumbling, where people are waiting years, and you've highlighted yourself in this programme, for long-term conditions that haven't been properly addressed, and they're suffering in real pain and anxiety as a consequence of that. So we do need to get real about how we're actually managing our public finances in Northern Ireland.
Let's move on then to something maybe you can give us more substance to, which is social care for older people. Mm-hmm. Massive. Huge election issue across the water. Mm-hmm. So your manifesto says Alliance believes that social care should be free at the point of access, funded by collective investment through the welfare state. So is total state provision of all social care for older people free at the point of use affordable?
It's affordable if you want to make it a priority and to make those investments. The difference is that if we go for what has been proposed, particularly by the Conservative Party, though I'm not quite sure exactly where they stand.
Well, they've rolled back from this now, haven't they?
To a certain extent. But what that comes across is a bit of a lottery. So if you're in a situation where you are suffering from dementia or some other type of condition where social care becomes relevant, then you're being asked that you have to fund that out of either your own money or out of any savings and investments that you have built up, whereas others who aren't in that situation get to keep their investments and savings. We don't apply that type of approach whenever we're talking about cancer, where the state intervenes and will, through the National Health Service, and will cover the full costs. So what we're saying is basically, why in terms of one set of conditions do we have to go for a particular solution where we pass the burden on to the individual to pay rather than the state collectively, whereas in other conditions we try to fund that collectively?
Isn't there a contradiction in the Alliance Party's central thinking that in the conversation we've just had, you want to raise money through progressive revenue raising, mm-hmm. in other words, people's ability to pay. Mm-hmm. And yet when we look at older people, you don't want it based on ability to pay, and you want the younger generations of voters to pay for them. So the rich multi-millionaire pensioners, it's not progressive. They can sit on their pile of cash while you're saying just a couple of minutes ago, progressive increases is the way to do it.
And Stephen, that then leads me to say that basically our approach is basically that we're all in this together.
Well, the pensioners aren't. Wealthy pensioners aren't, Stephen.
If we're part of a caring society where we have solidarity with one another, then this has to be a whole society approach.
So why should a wealthy pensioner be given a bye ball and the younger generation is paying for them?
That then lends the question in terms of how we fund this on a UK-wide basis through the taxation system.
Why should better off wealthy pensioners not contribute to their social care?
And then that suggests perhaps what we should be looking at changing the inheritance tax thresholds across the board for everyone.
And in terms of paying for social care,
yeah.
Why should wealthy, better off pensioners not pay for it? You believe in progressive revenue raising for rates.
What we're trying to say, Stephen, is to avoid a lottery situation here. So if we have, for example, some wealthy pensioners who do not have those type of conditions, they keep the savings and investments that they've built up. However, if you're talking about others who have the misfortune to come across those conditions, they then have to pay. That becomes a lottery. What I'm saying
is a lottery.
Well, it shouldn't be a lottery, because we should have a safety net across the board. When it comes to something like cancer, we all row in together, and the state takes care of those costs. But if you look, for example, at inheritance tax thresholds across the board, that will capture people irrespective of whether they have dementia or other similar conditions or not.
But you're talking about safety nets, right?
Yes, yeah.
But free at the point of use is not a safety net. That is a complete guarantee for everyone, including the wealthy. And someone's paying for it.
Yes.
And the people who are paying for it, if you protect the elderly wealthy, is the next generation, the younger generation. That money is coming from somewhere.
What I'm saying
is coming from other services, and the bill goes up and up and up.
And if you go for progressive taxation, and that includes looking...
You believe in progressive taxation.
Yes, and that includes looking at things like inheritance tax.
But in terms of social care, why do you not believe in progressive taxation?
But I'm saying, look at the inheritance tax and changing the thresholds. That is progressive taxation. That addresses your point that you're making.
Okay.
That addresses people who have built up a large degree of wealth as pensioners, irrespective of whether they have dementia or not,
All right.
and avoids that lottery
All
happening.
Right.